continue with the habit. But this time, I would like to look more at emotional habits and how in ourselves there seems to be again this groove of this feeling groove, this emotional groove, which we seem to, in a way, kind of go into again and again. And what is interesting, on a longer retreat, not on a day possibly, on a longer retreat, you can see them, like the conditions are quite propitious and we feel quite calm, and at the same time, we can see again and again this kind of groove kind of appearing. And so what I like to do this afternoon is just look at various trends that we can experience and to look at the feeling itself, which is a very normal feeling, and then to look how the habit in a way kind of can disturb it, can destabilize it, or can make it kind of again create tension with it, or can limit us when we experience it. So the first one I thought I would look into, since it's not often talked about in meditation, it's love. That actually, if we look at love, that we love a partner, that we love children, that we love friends, generally we have a lot of habits associated to it. I mean, the feeling itself is very natural. I think also the feeling itself, I think, is very healthy. To love ourselves, to love others, I mean, we recognize ourselves, we recognize others, we open to ourselves, we open to others. And I think as a feeling, it's a very important feeling to experience. But what is interesting is, again, if you look at the different levels, if we look at the intense level of love as a kind of pattern habit, we can think of falling in love. You know, when you fall in love, you really, I mean, you cannot be more intense. You kind of really, you know, totally in it, you're totally caught in, and if I may say this about falling in love, I think it's a state of great exaggeration in many different ways. I mean, you know, it's characterized by exaggeration and proliferation, and I think that's why it's so intense, because you're kind of like, this is, you know, I found the river and da-da-da-da, and it's I think what is important to see, I'm not against it, I think it's part of the course, but to see that often the mistake we make is we think it's going to last forever. You cannot fall in love forever. It happens. It's very intense. And then it diminishes. And then we have what I would call regular love, which then you can build, cultivate, develop. But falling in love, I think, is so intense already, I don't think you can intensify it more. And generally, it's not very practical. Generally, one is totally cannot see anything but the object of the love. And so in a way, to see that, I think to me it's not that you should not fall in love, but to see what happens when you fall in love. Because I know for myself, when I fell in love, I could see it was a very destabilizing, it was very kind of weird state to be in. And then when it stopped, I was quite happy. I mean, I was still in love, but I was intensity as well. Then there is habitual. You know, when in a way you have what I call habitual pattern associated with love. And that is interesting because often when you love somebody, you know, if you don't have a special object to love but you just love in general, the patterns are not activated. But suddenly you love a specific person, that it be a child or a partner or whoever, a friend, and it's very interesting. Suddenly all these habitual patterns comes in. And I think it is very important to see that. And often, one of the patterns that comes in with love in that way is fear. What if they leave me? What if they don't love me? It's very interesting to see straight away. There is this pattern. So to look at fear, to look at what are the things that comes around it. Or another thing you have with love is jealousy. This is very interesting, jealousy. That you want to be... The person must be with you all the time, must not look at anybody else or whatever it is. And also the idea in jealousy that love is fixed. So if he or she gives a little bit to somebody else, then it's less for me. Interesting. Well, actually, I think, you know, generally love kind of increase more than kind of get compartmentalized. But to look at this, I mean, I often when you see young children, you know, they have the favorite friend, you know, my friend, and then she must not be with anybody else, otherwise. And in a way, to look at what that creates, generally when you have a kind of what I would call an exclusive love, then generally you have the jealousy and generally you have the tension. So it's not that it's good or bad per se, but that often it causes tension, suffering. There is kind of all these things around it. And then you have the light, what I would call light faint pattern associating with love. And one of them is expectation. This is an interesting one. I was in my garden on a hot summer day working in the garden, and suddenly I thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a drink of water? Wouldn't it be nice if even my husband brought me a fresh glass of water? If he loved me, he would bring me a glass of water. And then he appeared without a glass of water. But I thought it was so interesting to watch it, to watch how it turned, how it kind of went into the pattern. It went into the... And with that, with the expectation, you go into this real fantasy. And you kind of, you know, expect things which... The person has no idea that you expect. I mean, that's one of the main problems, you know. So to see what are kind of, in a way, you have the feeling, and then what are the patterns that comes in with the feeling. Then you have another feeling which we is relatively common, is fear. And fear, again, I think is a very normal feeling, and I don't think meditation is stopping you to be afraid. But I think meditation can help us to be with fear in a different way, because I think it's a natural survival mechanism. It's very useful to have. If you see a car approaching you in the middle of the road, you're afraid, you jump, and then you get out of the way. But recently I had a very interesting experience with my niece. We went on one of these obstacle courses where you jump from tree to tree and do things like this, you know, very high in the tree. She's 9 years old. So we went on this long walk on the trees, you know, and you go higher and higher and higher. And very quickly, my niece said, "Oh, I'm afraid, I'm afraid, I'm afraid, I'm afraid." And in the middle of it, she said, "I'm too afraid, I want to go down." And we're in the middle of it, you know, we're 10 meters up in the tree, we can't go down, there is no elevator. So, you know, I coaxed her and I talked to her, you know, there are various things I say, and so finally we managed to get, you know, down. And then we walk to another activity, and then she turns to me and she said, "But Auntie, I was so afraid, and you were not afraid. How come?" And I said to her, "But look, we were attached to the safety line. Nothing can happen." I said, "Ah." And the next time we came, she checked first the line, and she jumped, and it was fine. And after that, she went, she ran anywhere, and she was not afraid. And she was in the same situation, the first one. And to me that was very interesting, as just by me showing her that it was safe, then the fear went. And I think in a way what is interesting with fear is that you have the reality of the situation, and then you have like a kind of exaggerated anxiety. What if this is going to happen? And to see where is a fear which is responding to the situation, and when is it that we proliferate and we exaggerate. And I think this is very much a pattern with fear. And also we fear to see that we fear. A lot of the time, we're not afraid in the present. We are afraid in the future. I think this is very important to see as a habit. And if you look at the present, you are fine. But you frighten yourself in terms of the future. So, fear, looking at when it's intense, you're suddenly afraid, really intensely afraid. I mean, once I was in a situation where somebody was starting to beat me up, a little bigger guy than me, and never happened to me before, so I was a little like, what's going on here? Then I had the fleeing response, I thought maybe I should jump out of the window, but it was the third kind of, we were on the kind of high in a building, so it would have been a little dangerous. So I thought, no, jumping out of the window is not a good idea. Then I kind of shouted, "Help, help," and then somebody came and stopped it. But to me, what was interesting in that moment of intense fear, first, I could not do anything. I was like, kind of rabbit in the headlight. What is going on here? And then, because I was not kind of totally overtaken by it, then I kind of could have the creative response. I think it's important to see that when the intense fear, two things happen. Either we paralyze, or either we go into aggression. That's another kind of habit in that moment. So again, to look, what happens when there is intense fear? What can I do with it? And I would say the meditation can help us to be more stable and open. Then there is less paralysis or less aggression, and then there can be a creative response. Otherwise, there is fear as a habit. That is interesting. Fear has a habit. It's kind of like a constant tension. You're kind of like always looking. And that's what you experience when you go to South Africa. We've been many times to South Africa. And I can judge the level of fear of others in terms of how I feel. If I am with somebody who is very frightened, then I become the same. It's very contagious fear. You know, I stayed once with a lady and she was so frightened. I was like, I've never been like this. I was really in constant tension. And then as soon as a friend of mine who is never afraid or very little afraid came, the fear went. I think it's also important to see that our habits can also influence others. Mm. It's not just for ourselves, but we can actually often communicate them. And so I think, again, it's to be careful of that. Not only it's for ourselves, but the influence it can have on other people. And recently, last time I was in South Africa, there was a wonderful story about this young woman. At the end of the retreat, we are talking about how can meditation help us in South Africa. And one lady said, well, it really helped me with fear. Before, I was so afraid. I would never go out of my house thinking, but if I go out, this will happen, that will happen, that will happen. So again, she was in the fear of the future. And then she kind of went on a meditation course and did a breathing meditation. And then slowly she kind of cultivated stability and openness. And then that really changed her life. So now she said, okay, I am going to go out. And then if something happens, I respond to it creatively, but I'm not going to be afraid of it in advance. And so now she said, I take my little car and I go here and there, and I'm free again. I'm a free person again. And then there is a light aspect of fear, and this is carefulness. And it's interesting to see how we, if, you know, we're careful, and are we careful in a way which is tense? Are we careful in a way which is stable? And often this is in a way the you can feel this with children. I know I have a lot of little nieces and things, and I can see, you know, as soon as they're on the road, I can, you know, you can see the tension arise, the fear, and you kind of try to kind of make sure. And then to see how, you know, when maybe it's very safe, then you still have that tension. So to see also that the fear is proportionate to the circumstances. I think that the light one is interesting to look at in terms of the proportion. Does it correspond or not to the situation? And so I would say in terms of that, I would say the meditation with fear can really help us in terms of stability. Because I think fear really is very destabilizing. So really to with a meditation to really cultivate this ground, this kind of stability, this confidence in ourselves, this confidence in our potential. So then we can have more like a creative response. Then another kind of a feeling, which I would say relatively common, is anger. This is something we most of us experience at some point in our life or at some point in our day, it depends. And what is its characteristic then is energy. I think it's very important to see anger is energy. It's fiery. It's kind of, you know, generally it agitates us. But at the beginning, it's energy. So I think if we're energetic people, we are more likely to be angry. When if we are less energetic people, we're more likely to have a different type of habitual mood. When it's intense, when you're intensely angry, then it's explosion. It's kind of like you kind of explode. And I think what is interesting to notice if you experience anger of that nature is that generally you lose sense. your wisdom goes. I think with anger, the first thing generally that goes is wisdom. You kind of, you see red and then you can't see straight. That's the expression. And again, total generally exaggeration. And it's very intense. So in a way to try to see how we can not get to that point. I think to me that's why it's so important to work at the light level, at the habitual level, because by the time you get to the very intense level, then sometimes you lose it, and then it can be very damaging for oneself, for others. So to be careful with frustration. So I think one of the things which is a key to this arising of intense anger is frustration. If you feel frustrated, and you can be frustrated for very good reasons. I mean, this happened to me a few years back when I was so frustrated by somebody. Ah, that finally I just exploded, but it did not serve anything. I mean, I did it, and it was like interesting to watch and to look at it, you know. And at the end of it, it did not last very long, 5 minutes. And then afterward, I thought, yeah, I mean, in that situation, it was not very useful, because then the person would say, ah, you know, she's exploding, you know, she's not a good meditator anyway, why should I care what she says? You know, so it kind of defeated slightly the purpose. But I could see why. The frustration, when you're so frustrated, sometimes you don't see any other solution. Then there is, which is interesting, is the habitual. When you're habitually kind of, and then it's more like irritation. And I think this is interesting to watch out, to look at, how we can be irritated. You can feel like, you know, irritable. And generally you see, if you're not conscious of the habit, if you are irritable, you generally think it's the fault of someone out there. You know? It's not my fault. I am a very contented, nice person. Somebody out there must be irritating me. I think we have to be very careful with that. I know for myself, I used to, you know, get irritable if I was tired. But I did not see that first. And so I used to look for somebody to be irritated with. And it was not very nice for them. Until I realized I was tired. So then I went, you know, to rest for an hour, and then I was much nicer. So I think it's very important to see, you know, this irritation, where does it come from? What is going on here? You know, is it physical? Is it mental? Is it emotional? And also to see, I think with the habitual, to see what is it that triggers the irritation. What is it that triggers the anger? I mean, we trigger generally because things don't go according to plan, we have some obstacle, somebody contradicts us. You know, also, I would say one word that really gets us, that's, I mean, it's a good recipe, is that if suddenly you say to yourself, this is unfair, then guarantee you will be angry. This is unfair. I used to say that to my husband. This is unfair. He said, yes. And the world is a fair place? Yes, yes. You see? and you see, yes, of course things are unfair. And of course we want things to be just. We want to work for justice. But you see what it sets up. To me, that's what is interesting. What is it that word sets up in ourselves in terms of habitual response, habitual story, which then, again, exaggeration, proliferation. And then there is a light manifestation of anger, kind of low-level irritation or impatience. Impatience is interesting. So this kind of, you have a little of anger there, you know, impatience. I think the supermarket queue is very good for that. Or driving. Driving is very good. Driving is an excellent opportunity to work with habits, you know. How do you drive? And somebody goes slowly. Very slowly. And what do you think? He does it on purpose. And personally, now I think, you know, he maybe is old, maybe he's looking for his, you know, something, or maybe his car is not working, and I don't think he does it on purpose. But you see, what is our, in a way, reaction? How we, something is triggered, and then how we add to it through the mental, emotional pattern. So now I think what is interesting to look at with anger is to look at what is the trigger, what is the contributing factor, and how do we feel. when we are angry. I think we have to look at all these different things and become more aware of how these three things generally come together. The trigger, the contributing factor, and the sensation itself, which I think feeds itself as well. And that's where the being aware of the mental story and being aware of the feeling becomes interesting. It's instead of going into the story of it, so adding to it, you go inside the feeling of the anger itself. Then you can just be with the energy of it, instead of, in a way, feeding it so much that then it has to express itself. And then you can be with it in a different way, and then it can just arise and go. It's not that you won't be angry, but that you can be angry for 30 seconds, and then you can see through it in a way. And then you can let go and then try to creatively engage with the situation. And there is another thing that we can experience. And this is also, I think, with anger, to say finally that it's energy. And I think it's an energy which can be used creatively, like with social work. My best moment with someone was at a big peace conference with the Dalai Lama. And this little guy coming up on the podium and saying, among all this peaceful stuff, "I am angry!" And I thought, who is this fellow? And he was angry at poverty. And he did this, he's a very famous fellow who died now, L'Abbé Pierre, but he was angry at poverty and he did something about it. So I think anger per se is not a bad feeling, it's just a feeling. What do you do with it? How can you be creative with it? And then the last feeling I want to just have a little look at, because it's something again which is relatively habitual, and it's low mood. Low mood, when we feel in a way low. I mean, the people who are angry generally have energy, and then there is some people who maybe have less energy. And then what they often experience is this kind of lowering of the mood. You don't feel much energy, we feel heavy, you feel grey. And again, to see this is a normal feeling when one has not so much energy, when one is ill, when things are a bit difficult, it's a very normal feeling. It's also a feeling which could help us to be more compassionate to others, I think. But it's in a way what typically can make us more sensitive. But when it's intense, then actually it is very difficult. When you are in this intense state of low mood, you have no energy, you don't want to do anything, you don't want to see anybody, you don't want to go anywhere. And I think it's very important to see that pattern-wise, the three patterning, emotional, mental, physical, go together. When I talk about it, I separate them. But actually they all go together. So this low mood is not in a way just a feeling, it's also the way of thinking, it's also a way of feeling physically. And I think when we feel like this, in a way, you feel like empty, there is loss, hopelessness, meaninglessness. And I think when one is in such a place, it's very painful. And that's why I think it's very important to see it at the light level, so one doesn't go into the intense level. Because the intense level is very difficult to shift because of the lowering of energy. You do less and less, so you want to do less and less. And you can do less and less. This is the thing. And what is interesting in terms of the science, that they found that if you just put somebody in a low mood on a kind of bicycling machine for an hour, they feel better because they move the energy. So in a way, this is, one has to be very careful not to go, if one can, into this intense kind of lowering of the mood, because it's very generally difficult to then to kind of move the energy again. Then there is the habitual place, the habitual tendency, where we feel blocked, and often it can come when we feel ill. But there is one habitual thing with this type, is the poor me syndrome. And this is, I think, something to really become aware, where we bring so much pain, which I think is not so necessary in a way. Is that when something doesn't work or something, I mean, you even do it with something as simple as waiting. Waiting. 9 o'clock. She's not there. 9:10. She does not love me. 9:20, nobody loves me. 9:30, I hate the world. But you can recognize this thing. Something doesn't go well and you think, oh, this is hopeless and everything is hopeless and yeah, nobody loves me and I've never accomplished anything in my life. And in a way, it's trend, this kind of hopeless loop we go in. This poor me. I think it's so habitual. And how can we, in a way, see through it? How we can see, again, the three things coming together, the mental, the emotional, and the physical. And to really, this one, I think, it's very important to break through it, not to repress it, but to see through it. To see, if I start here, I am going to go down there. And do you want to go down there? This is a question, you know? And to really, in a way, question that loop. Then you see also have a light manifestation where we kind of just have kind of like grey mood. We kind of just kind of feeling a little low. And then I think when you feel a little low, light manifestation is very important. To then go, I know it doesn't feel right to go and do something. To go and walk, to go and meet somebody, to go and do something, to move the energy. I think with that this is very important. Or if you're really so tired, to listen to some nice music, not too heavy metal, something a little like kind of, you know, a little more lively and kind of, you know, joyful. But I think it's very important to see, because often we think, oh, if I meditate long enough, then I won't have this mood. But it's not, that's not a guarantee at all, you know. So I think it's very important to really try to understand how it works. And also to cultivate what I would call a kind of like a positive, not just to cultivate working with the negative, but to cultivate working with the positive when the patterns are light. I cannot emphasize this enough, to really work, what is it that helps me to be less angry in normal time? What is it that helps me to be less low on normal time? And to cultivate those muscles. So that then, when you are in the daily life, and it's more difficult, then you can activate them. You cannot just think, well, I have to see through it, or I have to be more aware of it. That, I think, is not enough. I think the meditation helps us to be stable. The meditation helps us to be open and to be more aware. But then we need to have this creative move. We cannot just sit there. Sometimes we really... Of course, it's true. Sometimes the best thing is not to do anything, but to do it in a way which is creative. But sometimes we have to do something. We have to move. We have to act for our benefit and also for others' benefit. So this is what I wanted to say this afternoon. And so that's why I wanted to suggest for the afternoon, in terms of the meditation, to again be with the breath, or with the sound, or whatever you feel comfortable with, and then at some point in time, for a few minutes, just to be aware of the feeling tone. So not to even name the feeling, but try to be as close as you can to the experience, I would say physically, of the feeling. And to notice two things, that they are changing, they arise, and they pass away, and that when they stay for a while, they change within themselves. They are fluid. And also to see that a lot of the time, we actually don't feel very much. And that it's totally fine. And that actually we can rest in what I would call a kind of certain restfulness, certain contentment of just being alive in a simple way in that moment. So that's what I would suggest when you walk, when you sit, you know, focus on the body when you walk, and then just notice, trying to be with the feeling in a spacious way, and in this experiential way. And then when you sit the same, trying to be with the feeling in this spacious way, in this kind of as close as you can to them, without the naming, without the story. So, thank you. And so now there is just 10 minutes walking meditation, just to get a little fresh air. And also because after lunch it's always a kind of little difficult, so you might want to walk. If you feel sleepy, walk a little faster. If you don't feel sleepy, then you can walk slowly. And then we meet again here at 2:15.